in the transmission line will add up on each other. So by placing it closer to the feed point, you'll have less attenuation loss from reflections. It shouldn't really have that much effect in changing the ability of your tuner to tune or not tune. That's going to be inherent in the type of impedance or reactance that your antenna will show to the antenna tuner. If it shows you a impedance that it can't get rid of the reactance, it'll just fail on you. So although a length of cable, as I said, will rotate the impedance, if you connect it directly, you might find that the rotation is beneficial, but you might not. So it's a throw of the dice.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Roy. I really appreciate your wealth of knowledge and all the time you spend here. I thank you very much, and back to Ned.
You're welcome. I think I heard QGZ out there. He kind of doubled. Did you want to make a comment?
Just I'm sitting here in a shack, so let's run along here. I'm just curious, are we using any kind of counterpoise with that antenna? I know I have a similar radio. I have a KX2, and it does have the built-in whippy dippies you can put on top of the radio directly or mount on a little tripod or something. And they need a counterpoise, an approximate quarter wave counterpoise for the band you're operating on, just to go to a ground terminal somewhere on the radio if the antenna is right on the back of the radio, in order to make that work. So the whip by itself doesn't do very well, but adding a counterpoise makes it work a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, that's a good point. Rocco, have you used the counterpoise, or are you just using the grounding lug, or are you using either?
But as was just stated, all I did was I went with a small length of wire from the grounding point at the bottom of the the hamstick antenna and right to the grounding point on the bracket of the 705. But no, I did not use a counterpoise. Back to Ned.
Okay, that's another option also. A good counterpoise can improve the efficiency and change the overall impedance of an antenna. So you might want to give that a try as well because, wire is relatively inexpensive.
Thank you to both of you. I really appreciate it. I'm going to give it a shot. And thank you again. Back to Ned.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich. Yes, Rich, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I have a 9-foot rod, copper rod, in the ground, right where I want to anchor this vertical I'm talking about. Can I use that in any way with this antenna, and where would I attach it, and how would I attach it? Go ahead.
I think the only thing I would use that for is lightning protection and such. You're operating at relatively high frequencies. You already have ground planes on your antenna, so I don't think I would ground the radials. But you could set up something so that you have some degree of lightning protection. Although, you're not really going to elevate that antenna that far, so I would be amazed if you're going to get any lightning strikes or anything like that or static discharges.
Okay, and the other thing is, could you further explain when you said a magnetic loop on VHF and UHF frequencies really would be effective? Can you explain that a little further theoretically? Go ahead.
Well, the point of usually of using a magnetic loop, and some people don't even like that term because the magnetic aspect of an antenna in absence of an electric field discussion gives people a migraine and they don't believe it. So basically, a magnetic loop is really a shortened dipole that's distorted in a circular pattern. The benefit is that it doesn't require a great deal of elevation. And, you know, you could put it about 10 feet off the ground, and it works just as well as if you elevated it a great deal. And it's small, compact, and doesn't take up too much space, and you don't have to worry about mechanical constructs of three arms. You know, a dipole requires support at the center and at both legs. This just requires a single support at the post that's mounted the magnetic loop. So it's a way to get away with a lot of problems of low frequency, long wavelength transmissions. When you scale it up to the higher frequencies, those problems cease to really exist in the real world. No one finds a quarter wave 2 meter to be a big heavy thing that's difficult to mount and or difficult to stabilize. So it becomes unnecessary. It's easier to build something that's either a quarter wave or a half wave, not have to worry about the high Q, not have to worry about tuning it all over the 2 meter band. So you're in HF, you're trading problems of a mechanical size and structure for problems of tuning a high-Q device. In 2 meters and 70 centimeters, you're just introducing problems without any benefit.
I see, and there is no benefit because, you know, like a whip will do, that small whip will do at those frequencies, that's why there's no benefit?
Yeah, it's scaling it down to the size of the higher frequency. The only good thing that's about magnetic loops is that they're directional or bidirectional. And so if you're building some kind of a radio spotting device, they make a very good compact bidirectional antenna. You put a sense antenna on one of the two lobes, and now you have a unidirectional detection device. And so it works well. You don't have to worry about a high rated capacitor because you're not putting any current through it. It's purely a receiving antenna. So, when you scale things to different frequencies, some things become expensive or impossible, and when you change them in the other direction, they become rather simple to do. That's the case with high-frequency transmissions. Antennas are not that much of a problem as opposed to, 160 or 80 are a pain in the backside to handle and to keep up in place.
Got it now. Thank you, Roy.
GZ?
Yes, QGZ.
Advantage of the loop at V and U, because you get a UHF loop as well, and I'm not sure of that offhand, the wavelength, the proportion of the antenna. It could be a full wave loop. It's possible. The advantage of that antenna is it's an omni-horizontal, right? So you don't mount it so like you're looking at an O. When you look at it from the side, it's flat, and that... The advantage of that is if you just put up, you wanted a general purpose horizontal antenna for U or V, you put up a horizontal dipole made out of two rigid elements, which is real easy to make. It's not omni, right? So you'd have to have some means of rotating it. So the loop is, you feed it at 50 ohms with a gamma match, and it allows you to have a horizontal omni versus just putting up a quarter wave vertical, which would be an omni but vertically polarized, as opposed to the loop, which would be horizontally polarized. Make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. I don't think they're, by definition, magnetic loops. Magnetic loops tend to be about 10% to 20% of the wavelength. So for a 2 meter, it would be a circumference of about 0.2 meters. And I don't know, you're a better judge of what the circumference of your antennas are.
And when we say a loop, a style of a loop antenna, I guess, is that 6 meter Saturn antenna, which is sort of loopish oval, mounted horizontally. The antennas I'm referring to, most of them are actually not loops. They're rectangular. And if I had to take a stab at it, I'd say 6 to 8 inches on a side, approximately. They mount in the center or towards the feed point, and the rest of that, the rest of the antenna just goes out, and the ends come in on each other on the far end, obvious opposite the feed point. They don't quite touch, if that makes sense.
Okay, it doesn't strike me as your classical magnetic loop. Magnetic loops are either loops. They can be rectangular, but they end in a variable capacitor that's tunable, and then there's a secondary coil or a tap point in which the magnetic loop is driven, or the receive signal is taken from. So it sounds more like a full loop design or a proto or pseudo full loop design, which yeah, it can be very effective, but it's a different kettle of fish, I think.
Yep, I concur. It's certainly not the traditional magnetic loop design with a smaller loop to feed or match. And again, it takes 50 ohms in its input, and a lot of times it'll be a gamma style match for this thing. So yeah, not magnetic, and closer to full wave. I'll go with that. Give you an omni signal at when you're horizontally polarized. So there you go. WE2QGZ.
Okay, very good. So I hope everyone got their answer this time as well. Anyone else with any questions or want to discuss something, aspect of something that they heard earlier tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KV2QPV.
Yes, QPV.
Evening, Brian. I have an RV5 antenna, and I was wondering, it has a 40 to 20 to 10, and I have it about 75 feet up a ladder line, 32 feet plus a LMR 475. 75 feet. I was wondering if I have to ground it by the window, lightning arrestor.
Well, I mean, it's always a good idea to put a lightning arrestor just to be on the safe side. You should never kind of have the coax go into your shack and then have the ground connection go out of your shack and assume that that's really protecting the antenna, because what happens is it goes into your shack and it might go out again, but it might not. So there are all kinds of lovely little connectors that are available for coax that have a ground connection, and you could either use, if you have a backyard, if you can. Sometimes, actually, cable companies and such will put down a will tap a ground line, and if you lend it to yourself, they don't usually notice. Or if you don't have a ground pipe, you could put one in, or if you have just a cold water pipe feeding your garden in the backyard, you can tie it to that, and that's a decent ground as well. So I think you should have a ground. There are a lot of people who unfortunately don't, and fortunately they get away with it.
Sorry, I understand. Because the manufacturer say to not ground this antenna up in the C point, all the way up to feed it down at the end of the C point, the closest to the ground with a lightning arrestor.
Yeah, I wouldn't tap the metal of the antenna. Like I said, probably I would simply ground the outer shield of the cable on its way towards your shack. You know, it's going down from your roof, I guess, and through LMR 400. So you put a little ground connecting a discharge coupler between it, weather seal it nicely, and run the ground to an outside ground.
Thank you very much, Roy. KD2QPV, Jose, back to net control.
You're welcome, Jose. Anyone else with any comments on this particular subject or any other subject, please feel free. Give me your first name and your call sign.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I always like the idea of what you said, to just ground at least the shield. And, you know, if you had a ballon, then that's even better because both sides of the antenna, are essentially the same. And you tend to, normally you tend to build up a charge on your antennas. You know, if the wind is blowing by, you're developing a charge. And that kind of, acts like a lightning... something that, the lightning sees that and wants to hit that if you've got a charge from just wind going. So as long as you have some kind of ground on that, onto a water pipe or something in the house, you don't have to go out. So at least you're counteracting that effect of creating a charge on it. Lightning rods. You're trying to avoid a lightning rod in this case, and that's what you're really doing if you don't have some kind of ground to lead that off. And I've seen that. I'll take my dipole and my PL259 when I connect it, and sometimes I'll connect it. I'll see a little spark jump. I don't even have to have a radio connected. You'll see a spark jump. That means there's a charge on that antenna. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, as far as static discharge goes, you don't have to worry too much. You can ground it with an internal ground in your shack or an external ground. But if there's any risk of lightning and you really want to protect yourself, the best cases are the guys who actually disconnect their antennas from their shack and leave the connection open or kind of close. Put a cap on it and put it out the window hanging. You don't want to introduce any lightning into your shack, even if it is set to go to ground. Before it gets to ground, it can make a mess doing other things. So if you're at all worried about lightning protection, try to find an external ground for your antenna as opposed to an internal one. If it's just a matter of discharging random static electricity, internally discharging it to an internal ground is fine. Please, everyone, do not use your electrical outlet as a ground. Electrical outlets are grounded at the incoming area in your house, and from then on, it's anyone's guess what that ground potential really is. There's leakage current all over the place, and you never know what you're getting if you try to use your electrical outlets ground as a ground for your antenna system. So use a cold water pipe if you can get one. You might get away with a hot water pipe that has some problems in it, but the cold water is preferred. But, you know, an external ground, if you can do it, is the best approach. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and this is Limark's Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature or a science nature or medical nature, as long as it's not your own personal medical problem, you know, a general type of a question, then please feel free. Give me your first name and your call sign.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
Okay. Science. Causation. Correlation. You had a post concerning it's physics. When you have a mass, the mass distorts space and time, and it's that distortion of time that creates gravity. So are we saying that time is the causation for gravity?
Well, yes, we are. And thanks for picking that little topic. It's one of my favorites. There is an interesting way of discerning, and, you know, people argue this regularly, that gravity isn't actually a force, that gravity is probably more accurately should be considered a pseudo-force, that it is something that from our frame of reference looks like a force, the same way as a centrifugal force is a pseudo force. So the understanding is, and it gets a little esoteric because everyone kind of knows the conservation of momentum law. That's a mass times velocity without any additional energy is conserved. So no matter what you do, momentum in equals momentum out. But there's a more complicated version of momentum called four momentum, which is in four-dimensional space-time. And in that way, every object is traveling at the same speed through space-time. Part of that is they're traveling through time. Part of that is they're traveling through space. If you increase your speed through space, you decrease your speed through time, and that's the time dilation effect of acceleration. As you speed up, time for you slows down, and everyone around you ages faster than you perceive they should. So the bottom line is, as you go closer and closer to the Earth, your time slows down. If your time slows down and you have to conserve four momentum, your speed has to go up, or something like your speed has to go up. And the way that we perceive that strange quality of speed pushing us is that there's a force that we call gravity. So the more that you slow down time, the more you feel the force of gravity on you, just to conserve four momentum.
Okay. Four momentum. Fourth dimensional. Now, I've seen the time versus space graphs. And if you look at an XY graph, the corollary is that if you're going, say, due east at 100 miles an hour, you're not moving in a northern direction at all. However, if you turn
and now you're going northeast, you're not going 100 miles an hour east or 100 miles an hour north. You're probably going around, what, 70 or something, but you're going 100 miles an hour northeast. So take one of those axes and change it to time, so that now it's time versus space. So I see how they one bleeds off the other. Excuse me. So because of this distortion of time, the time dilation, time is slower near the surface of the Earth. And as you move away from the Earth, it increases. And to make up for that, there's a what we perceive as a gravitational force. But it's really something that's inducing a displacement in space again. So is that kind of what's happening?
Yep, that's pretty much a way of describing it. There are numerous different ways. It seems rather bizarre, but that it goes all the way back to the general theory of relativity. Einstein wrote it up way back when, and a lot of physicists truly believe in it. They think that that's part of the reason why. There's always been a question of the orders of magnitude of the four fundamental forces or four fundamental interactions. Physicists love semantics. That gravity is ridiculously weaker than all three of the other forces. And the question has always kind of been in the background of why that's so. And one of the reasons that some physicists give is because it's not really a true force. So that's why it makes no particular sense in relation to the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, and the electromagnetic force.
Because it's not a force, but it's a perception, which looks like a force to us, but it's really the distortion of space-time, which is very hard to wrap one's head around. All right, so here's where I get confused. Now, we talk about time dilation, the twin paradox. The guy goes out in space. He ages at a certain rate. Meanwhile, people back on Earth aged at a different rate. And that's due to his spilling off of time because of his velocity. So his time is slowed down relative to ours. But it's relative. So here's where I kind of mess up. He comes back. He's maybe aged a year. People maybe aged 10 years or 20 years relative to that. I guess I get confused because it's not the difference in his velocity versus our velocity through space, time. Because everything is relative. So wouldn't his relative differential in speed to us be the same as ours to him? So why is it that he gets the benefit? Is it because space-time itself is a constant, let's say, and everything is relative to that space-time? So there's three things involved. There's our position on Earth, there's his position going through the cosmos, and there's the cosmos itself, right? It's got to be three. If it's just me and him, it doesn't matter which end we take, right? So there's got to be that third entity. I don't even know if you understand what I'm trying to get at, but let's see if you do. Go ahead.
I'm not 100% sure. The difference is that we're in an inertial framework. Our frame of reference is an inertial one. His is always being accelerated. Again, if you want to go semantically, it's acceleration, deceleration, and further acceleration. It's constant acceleration. So his is a non-inertial framework. So all the frame of references are different for the two. So yeah, I can understand why you wonder about. Why can't you flip it the other way if everything is relative? But I guess a part of that answer is because of the difference between an inertial and non-inertial frame of reference.
Anyway.
Yes, Hank.
Given in the twins paradox explanation, and it essentially agrees with the your discussion of acceleration, deceleration, acceleration again being different than the inertial framework of the other one.
Yes, that's what I'm getting at. So that's where the difference is, although I could understand the problems with the general concept of relativity. Everything is relative, but they're not identical, and there are transform equations that will adjust for things like the apparent distance between objects changes as you speed up. And so there's a Lorentz transform that describes and defines it, but they're not symmetrical. They go in one direction or the other, but not in both of them.
Let me see if I have it. All right, so I should distinguish, I guess, between speed and acceleration, velocity and acceleration. So it's the acceleration, which is at play here, more than the difference in velocity. And I guess when you refer to an inertial frame, that's a frame without acceleration. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So again, is the acceleration relative? Well, if I'm not accelerating at all, I'm in an inertial frame, and the astronaut is accelerating. In this twin paradox, it's only the acceleration which is causing the time dilation. So let's say he accelerates to a certain velocity, maintains that velocity for a year, and then decelerates and comes back to Earth, what have you. It's just the acceleration phase and the deceleration phase which is causing the time dilation, but not so that full year of constant velocity on his part. Is that correct? Even though his velocity is much faster than mine.
I think the ultimate terminal velocity that the person reaches will have a sustained effect. I mean, theoretically, if you take it to the absurd, where you accelerate to the speed of light, and then you just careen at the speed of light, forget the fact that that's impossible, then as far as that individual is concerned, time has stopped for him. So if he sits there at the speed of light, while the outside universe travels through 1,000 years and then he hits the decelerator for the same amount of time, the world's going to be older. So although the fact that he's accelerating and decelerating, the velocity that he's traveling in will also determine the speed at which he travels through the fabric of time itself.
Yeah, so time will stop for him at the speed of light. He'll be massive. He'll be infinitely massive. So I guess what do they call that? When you're just hitting, asymptotic. I guess, he'll be 99.9999% to the speed of light, but massively heavy. So that would be a massive space-time distortion. So, okay. All right. And you think speed is the delta in speed also. How is that? All right, I think that's enough for now. Thank you, Rory.
Okay, you're welcome, Lou. Thanks for bringing up the subject. I really like talking about this. That's why I kind of threw it up there on my link page. There are objects that are even more flaky. Tachyons are imaginary particles. I don't think they exist. They fulfill something called Dirac's equation. If instead of using a real number for the mass, you use an imaginary number for the mass, it gives you these particles with very interesting properties that I don't think exist. At rest, They travel at infinite speed. As you apply more and more energy to slow them down, they approach the speed of light but never reach it, for the same exact reason why anything that has rest mass will never reach the speed of light on the other end. The mass increases, the energy requirement increases, theoretically black holes get created and mess things up. So it's an interesting theoretical particle that's used in Star Trek and all kinds of science fiction as ways of going faster than the speed of light.
And why, too? Someone once asked me, why is the speed of light what it is? And we pondered and thought maybe, well, since everything is discrete, we go through the smallest units of length, the Planck constant, and I asked him, well, if the Planck constant were a different value, would that change the speed of light?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting point. I don't think it would, personally. The speed of light itself is not the fundamental to the speed of light. We kind of think of it as that because that's the way that we phrase it. It seems to be actually the speed of causality in space, in the fabric of space-time itself, which is much more difficult, I guess, to wrap your brain around, because gravitational forces are transmitted at the same speed of light. So things that are have unlimited causality can travel at the speed of light, because that's the highest that causality, that cause and effect, can occur in space-time itself. So that's probably why things like the speed of light are the number that they are, simply because of that. Now, you know, some people will tell you, well, but the Faraday's equation will actually tell you the speed of light in a vacuum. And, in fact, they do, but they don't kind of go into the fact that you first have to know constants like permeability and permissivity or such that have the speed of light kind of hidden inside them, waiting to come out. So, you know, how you figure out those things without knowing the speed of light or doing an experiment that requires you to figure out the speed of light, I don't know. But that's my best way of saying what the speed of light really means. It's the speed of cause and effect through the fabric of space-time itself.
So space-time has an inherent property which, from which emerges the speed of causality. Now, gravity waves, we've started to detect them, and we detect them because of a change in the distance between two points, I think, right? But since we said before that gravity is a effect of time dilation being the cause, are we seeing both space and time dilation? Is that what a gravity wave really is? Is it a perturbation in the space-time continuum?
Yeah, you got to be careful with the semantics. They're gravitational waves. They're not actually waves of gravitons or that's another theory in quantum mechanics, that the energy carriers, you know, the way that the photons are energy carriers for the electromagnetic field, that there are such things as gravitons that carry the force, if there is a force, of gravity. These are gravitational waves, and what they are, as you mentioned, they're undulations in space-time, in the fabric of space-time itself, so that when those space-time distortions pass by an interferometer of miles and miles and miles, all of a sudden the dimensions change ever so slightly, ever so quickly. You know, sizes of a neutron in length for mile-long interferometers, and they're able to be detected.
to something else. Thank you. And Y2H.
Okay. And thanks again, Lou. I appreciate the chance of chatting up physics. I like physics a lot. I realize some people it gives a headache. One little thing I'll just throw out for the audience is entangled particles kind of drive everyone crazy because entangled particles seem to be able to transmit their states instantaneously, not at the speed of light in a vacuum. So there's a lot of problems in trying to explain how entanglement works. And Einstein famously really hated, although he brought up the whole premise himself, he hated the idea of it from the get-go, and that's where the line, how did he phrase it, you know, forces at a distance, or you know, strange forces at a distance. So entanglement kind of screws up the whole point of causality of space-time, and there's a bunch of theories about delocality of things, that you don't have to be in a place to affect something in that place. You can be in a different place, but that's a subject, I guess, for another night.
Spooky.
Yes, spooky action at a distance. Thank you very much. Yes, Rich.
Roy, COVID, have the vaccines lived up to their expectations 100%? Go ahead.
Well, as close as I could see, they pretty much have. We've been incredibly lucky. Things could have gotten bad every which way. We were using new technology that had never before been used for a commercial vaccination. But both the Pfizer and the Moderna have come through with reported 94% efficacy. They've demonstrated that the Pfizer is very effective for younger people, in addition, because the initial study was for adults. So they tried teenagers recently. They found that the infectivity has plummeted, the complications kind of non-existent. It seems to be very effective so far, even for the variants at this point in time. It's all subject to change because the variants can mutate into something else. Most of the mutations in the metropolitan area are very close to the UK model. They're slightly different, but and so far studies that I've read suggest that the variants can be dealt with by the vaccine. So if people take the vaccines, they are probably going to be incredibly effective. And you can pretty much take a look at them in the in the numbers being generated and being crunched. All of a sudden, the number of elderly people with incidence of the disease, hospitalization for the disease, and mortality from the disease have plummeted. Unfortunately, younger people who were not in the group to be early vaccinated have risen up and taken their places. So although everyone was hoping for a progressive decline, we not only leveled out earlier, but we're now creeping up, and younger people are infected, younger people are hospitalized, and younger people, unfortunately, are dying. So I think if we're able to expedite the vaccination and anti-vaxxers kind of go off someplace to a desert island and not bother us, things will get a lot better. We might have another wave until then, because a lot of people are just tired of social distancing, and so they're breaking a whole bunch of rules, even though they haven't gotten their vaccines yet. So I'm incredibly optimistic. I am not a terribly optimistic person by nature, but the vaccines have turned out miraculously. I probably wouldn't have predicted last year that they would be as good as they are, as quickly as they are.
YDY.
Yes, Hank. Yes, Hank, you have a question?
There was an article on NPR, National Public Radio. I guess you wouldn't call it an article, but, you know, a segment, where they suggested that some of the long-term testing that most other vaccines have had has obviously not had time to have been accomplished with these new vaccines. And there's some concern about long-term health issues, especially with, I'm drawing a blank, please forgive me, I think I want to call it autoimmune diseases. Have you heard about this, and do you have a comment on it?
Well, that's up in the air. That's one of the big problems. If you only test something for 9 months, you only know what it does in 9 months. So can it bite us in the ass? I guess theoretically, it's supposed to kick our immune system into operating. Is it possible that it's going to overreact in some people's immune system and they'll develop autoimmune disorders? I guess so. But then you also have to measure it against the half of a million people who died of disease of in the last 9-10 months. I have heard that there's a question about AstraZeneca, that there seems to be a possibility of an elevated clotting occurring with people who take the AstraZeneca, but that's still up in the air whether that's legit or not. Any vaccine, I guess, theoretically could give you some kind of autoimmune disorder, and we won't ultimately know the extent of the risk until years from now. So, yeah, it's possible that that we got a booby prize, but it was kind of inherent in the design of what we decided, that we simply don't have 5 years to spend with elderly people and middle-aged people dying, waiting to assess completely the safety of it. So we took a chance. Hopefully we didn't take a stupid chance.
Well, in aviation, we'd call that threat assignation, and the short version of that is dealing with the alligator that's closest to the boat. So I certainly understand what you're saying, but it was simply something that I heard and I wanted to hear your opinion of. So thank you very much, and one whitey white.
You're welcome, Hank. Any other questions? If not, I have a puzzle or two that I'll share with you guys and gals, but if you have any other questions, please feel free, hit the push-to-talk button.
Unknowns, and what would be the nature of those unknowns? Go ahead.
Say again, Rich. I only heard the second half of your message.
You said that, they're trying stuff that's never been tried before, and I was wondering, what's the nature of that stuff that's never been tried before? Go ahead.
Okay. The two most famous vaccines that most of us have been injected with are a class called messenger RNA vaccines. This is brand new and shiny, although research and theory have gone on for 20 years in this subject, but this is the first time that this method was used to produce a commercially produced vaccination. The method that it does is they took the genetic code of the of the virus initially in China, and it's available on the web. You can look it up, and matter of fact, there's a complete decode for Moderna's genetic code sequence as well. They took the code for the spike protein. That's the method that the COVID virus invades the cell membrane, and they replicated messenger RNA that codes for building that protein in the body when it gets infected. They then covered it in a layer of lipids to protect it and inject it into your arm. The little lipid layer merges with your cell membrane. The messenger RNA goes out into your cytoplasm. It gets picked up by ribosomes, which were designed to make proteins for you based upon the messenger RNA that you produce. Your cell doesn't know who produced this messenger RNA, but since it's in the cell, what the hell, it'll pump out proteins. So it pumps out a whole bunch of proteins for the spike protein, and then it releases it into the intracellular space, into your lymphatic systems, and goes into your lymph nodes, where your lymph nodes say, what the hell is this? And they start to build a defense. They start to build cells that produce antibodies that will engulf and tag it for destruction. It designs killer lymphocytes that will detect it and destroy it as well. And that's the underlying method of messenger RNA vaccines. In the previous decades, vaccines were either killed viruses or viruses that were bred to be relatively safe and not terribly infectious. But this is an entirely new class of vaccines that can be turned around much, much, much more quickly than the previous type. Rubella, I think, took 4 years from starting to finish as far as building a vaccine for rubella. But, you know, this is 9 months, was heck of a lot of a faster rate.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, I talked a wee bit too much. I hope I got most of that out before I timed out.
You got up to rubella, about to finish. WS to it.
Okay, the point with the rubella is that it took 4 years to develop that vaccine. It's a much more classically designed vaccine. So doing 9 months was a miracle. And they did it twice. Basically they used the same principle. There was a little bit of difference. Moderna has that lipid protection so that it's less sensitive to temperature problems. But fundamentally, the Moderna and the Pfizer are both messenger RNA vaccines.
So you're saying they made assumptions that could have easily gone the other way?
Well, the theory was decent, but it wasn't proven. And they had done test cases, and in those limited test cases, it seemed to work out in the lab. But they had never had the opportunity to scale it up into a commercial product. So it was still a possibility that it would have flopped. Merck, I don't exactly know the technology that Merck used in its vaccine attempt, but it was a complete failure, and they discontinued it a month or two ago and reported that they were doing that. And now they're basically helping, I believe it's Johnson & Johnson. I could be wrong. Could be some other company make their products out of their labs, because Johnson & Johnson seems to have a problem upscaling. And the Johnson & Johnson vaccines had bad luck, not the vaccine itself, but there were contaminated samples where they threw out millions. They've had limited production, so they've had a lot of problems.
All right, fascinating. I guess it seems like 99% of it went in the right direction. Some of it by pure luck. Aren't we a lucky race? Thanks, Roy.
Yeah, this time it seems that the luck was with us. I'll be curious and interested to find out the legitimate efficacy of the other international vaccines, the Sputnik V of Russia, there's a Chinese vaccine that I don't know exactly what method they're using. There's an Indian vaccine, but I think it's simply just a version of AstraZeneca's that the Indian pharmaceutical companies are just pumping out for third world countries and such. So it'll be interesting to see. The only complete failure that I know of at this point is Merck. No one else has claimed the failure publicly, at least. So it'll be interesting to find that out.
Thanks, Lord. W2BZ.
You're welcome. Let me ask you a little puzzler. It's a little astronomical puzzler. You know, there's a certain plane to the solar system. All the planets pretty much rotate in the same plane at different distances in different elliptical orbits. And all the planets have their own spin. You know, ours is 24 hours. It's about, I think there's a 23-degree inclination in on the Earth, which means it's tilted by 23 degrees. So my astronomical question for tonight is, are there any planets in our solar system that spin at 90 or close to 90 degrees out of whack? So in other words, it's circling in one direction, its axis, and it's rotating internally 90 degrees or more off that axis. So does anyone know if there's any planet like that?
And WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
You got Uranus. Uranus, the pole is like facing the sun. So it's pretty far. It's almost like a 90.
Yep, Paul, you're absolutely right. It has an inclination of 97 degrees. So it's lying there on its side rotating. You know, each planet has their own inclination. You know, most Earth, Mars, I think Saturn, basically have anywhere from, we have 23 and Saturn has 26 or 27. So those three planets are really close. You know, Mercury is smack dab zero inclination. So yeah, it's Uranus is on its side. So congratulations, you answered the puzzle.
Yeah, okay. I think Mars is 24, very close to us as well.
Yeah, I have 25.2 degrees.
Okay, I know it's very close. The only difference, of course, they have, you know, twice as long of a season. You know, their summers are twice as long, their spring is twice as long, and winter. But, yeah, very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okie doke. I have one more puzzler for tonight. Well, if we need more, I can always pull out more. And it has to do with our discussion of the speed of light in a vacuum. And is also, like a lot of things in physics, subject to arguments. Not all physicists will agree, and there'll be semantic arguments and logical arguments. But nevertheless, let me throw this one out. Give or take 10 years, what year was the speed of light in a vacuum measured in one direction without making any previously unproven assumptions? So anyone want to guess? You got a 10-year plus or minus range that you can feel comfortable with.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is that the Michelson experiment? That was probably the early 1900s, right? 1910, something like that.
Yeah, but that wasn't the one-way trip to of light. It was going back and forth.
Okay, I didn't understand the question then. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, anyone want to hazard a guess? Yeah, I don't get points off. It's just what period of time in our history do you think it was proven the speed of light going in one direction only was